welcome everyone to EdRink. The last time I had a conversation with Alison and Amy was about teenagers and sleep. I now know from Alison that teenagers have a delayed 1 hour sleep pattern. Mm-hmm. They're sitting on Zurich time and not South African time. We floated the idea after an hour of just really talking about sleep and sleep hygiene and things. But what really piqued my interest was just almost a throwaway comment about ADHD. Mm-hmm. And how parents are medicating these kids to sleep. So they take the uppers and then they take the downers, and these are young minds that are still growing and developing. Mm-hmm. Never mind the physical manifestation of what that looks like. It's also the psychological manifestation of what we're teaching our kids, the identity around that and how they feel about it. So in the spirit of what EdRink is all about, community and career in the community, we all often are so busy in Joburg, we don't know who's doing what. It takes a community to grow children. So The first step is to create a community around and an awareness around all of these things so that people are going, oh, I know somebody who can talk about this. This is stuff that's coming up, and that we can create that interconnected web of what's going on. We all want to do what's best for the kids in our care and the parents, and specifically parents who've become specialists via Google and now AI and sit in the office telling us how it is and what's going to happen, and especially medicating away the problems. And sometimes children need to go through a journey to get to the end of it. You can't medicate in resilience, and you can't medicate in good sleep hygiene and good tech habits and things like that. This is the first fireside chat. South Africa has a wealth of world-class knowledge and talent. And certainly as an educator myself, I need to speak to every single one of you about the different things that you do to create and help with the tapestry of what educating children looks like. So Alison, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to let you do your own introduction and who you are.
So I'm Dr. Alison Bentley. I'm a GP by training, but I've had a special interest in sleep ever since I began. I mean, I pretty much figured out very quickly that I couldn't be a good GP, that I needed to specialize somehow, and ended up accidentally in sleep medicine, stayed in sleep medicine because it's just so interesting and so fascinating. And it's also something that everybody can identify with because everyone does it. Mm. You know, so everyone is interested in sleep. So I've kind of done a private practice in sleep. I've kind of gone back to do research and got my PhD in restless leg syndrome, and then went back into practice. And more recently, set up the Restonic Essentia Sleep Clinic with Restonic to really move sleep out of an elitist kind of medicine field, which it is sitting at the moment. If you're on a medical aid, you can have access. If you don't, you don't have access. So to move it into a market where the public sector can have access and we can do some research on South African problems, pretty much all the data we use when we speak to patients is derived from Harvard or Europe or Australia, with very few numbers of black patients or African patients in them. And we know that they are prone to different diseases. We know that they respond differently, and we don't have data. So the Restonic Sleep Clinic is sitting in Parktown, and that's where I practice from. I think what's useful for me is, as a GP, I have a very holistic view of patients. I'm not stuck in a little silo. So I see patients from 6 months old to kind of get them to sleep, to patients of 80, and everything in between, and every single sleep disorder. I learned very quickly that I couldn't just do sleep apnea, because that's the big business in sleep medicine, because doctors sat there and went, is this sleep apnea? Will Alison see them? So I went, I'll see anything. So I do see patients with insomnia, sleep apnea, narcolepsy, the whole bang shoot. So it's always interesting because I never know who's going to walk through the door. And I have a special interest in children's sleep because I think it's just assumed that children sleep well. Like, that's just assumed. Like, they sleep well, right? And I kind of go, no, they don't, actually. If you look at the data, the prevalence of sleep disorders is pretty much the same no matter what age you are. And what, particularly when it comes to ADHD, really many years ago, kind of went, hang on a second. Like, we use the same medications to treat narcolepsy, to keep people awake, as we do to keep children focused. Like, that's odd, isn't it? Like, are we having a conversation about this? Is there any sense that we're kind of going, are these children actually sleepy? And that's why the medication works, because it's waking them up. So that's where my interest comes in. And I've done a couple of talks to neurologists and pediatricians, etc., on ADHD and sleep and how it links together. But it's just not kind of seen, the sleep problems that kids with ADHD have, partly because I think doctors only see people when they're awake. They don't think about what's happening at night and how that contributes to what they're seeing during the day.
A third of their life.
Yeah, it's and you know, the point is, the whole point about sleep is to get you ready for the day. Like, yeah. That's the whole point. Yeah. So if you don't sleep well, you're not ready for the day. Yeah. And how it presents is different in different ages.
Yeah.
And I think, I know there are a bunch of kids who are sleepy during the day and they present with inattention. I mean, all of us know if you have a bad night's sleep, you have an attention deficit the next day. Not the disorder, but an attention deficit. Yeah. You can't focus, you can't concentrate. You don't want to do any hard work. And so, you know, I'm really interested in that link, and I think we need to talk about it more.
Well, we have some people that are part of this conversation tonight.
Mm.
And I think it would be great for you just to grab the mic and introduce yourself and what your field of expertise is and what you're hoping to get out of this, because it gives us an idea of what direction to go in and what questions we might answer.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Cynthia Potia, and I'm an educational psychologist practicing in Bryanston. And I work at a high school part-time.
Okay.
What I'm expecting, I thought the topic was quite interesting. And a lot of the teens that I speak to at the high school, sometimes I don't know how they survive the day because they're only getting 2 to 3 hours of sleep. And this is on a daily basis. Mm. And I'm just... It baffles my mind. So, yeah, I just really wanted to find out a bit more and understand that link, especially like you say, with ADHD. I've seen some kids as well, younger, maybe like grade 1, grade 2, who are struggling with sleep, but also have a diagnosis of ADHD.
My name is Lauren Edmonds, and I run a remedial and special needs school in Fairland called Amartis. The type of children that we have sit under banners of ADHD and autism and nonverbal. And the type of children that I deal with is the kids that even your smaller special needs schools won't take.
Mm.
I'm interested in the sleep because there's basic tenets that I need to work with the parents on. Nutrition, connection, play, sleep. But sleep is a big component. There's a saying that is going around saying, parents medicate their children when the parent isn't coping. And I think that happens with sleep predominantly.
Hmm.
And then I've got parents who won't give their child melatonin because they think it's going to be a problem.
Mm.
But they're happy with their child at the age of 7 only sleeping for 2 hours. And to try and engage that conversation so they understand a healthy approach to this. So I'm very interested in it. Broader than just ADHD, but how that all links.
My name is Naledi Mugwena. So I practice as an educational psychologist. I'm based in private practice in Sandton. It's a good traffic drive on the way here. So I work with age groups like 4, lots all the way through childhood, lots of teenagers, as we're speaking about now, and young adults to about the age of 35. I do specialize in neurodiversity. So I do therapeutic work and these days lots of assessments.
My name is Amy Dews Gulborn, and I'm from Bryanston High School. I head up the psychology department as well as the concessions department. I'm finding more and more in my concessions department that ADHD is very, very underknown by the parents or ill-informed. Because I specialize in teenagers, there's also such a big collaboration between normal teenage development in the brain and sleep that changes with that versus ADHD symptoms versus depressive symptoms with anxiety. So the linkage between the three is fascinating for me, and that's what I'd like to discuss to then try and take back the knowledge to my school.
I'm Gershon Matheson. I'm the co-founder and headmaster of EduInc. We're a small school, boutique school, mainstream school, but we cater for kids who are square pegs in the round hole. The ADHD kids, kids who might have dyslexia, socially not fit in, kids who are high-performance sports kids who really need some special attention in that as well. We're not a remedial school, but we are able to facilitate students through their journey with accommodations from the IAB and things like that. Because of the nature of our school, through anxiety, through ADHD, depression, things like that, we have a lot of medicated kids. The more informed we are in talking to our clients, the more interconnected the network is and the understanding. We know who to refer to. We know who the right people are, because opinion is not fact. We'd like to deal with facts. So, yeah, let's start off with a child who's sleepy in class and the comment you made about perhaps they are not focusing in class and diagnosed with ADD because they and drifting because they are tired, not because they necessarily need to be stimulated.
I think the sleepy child in a class is a major problem. They should not be that sleepy. They often get caught between homework and having to like stay up late at night to do homework, then having difficulty falling asleep, the whole screen problem. There's a whole bunch of things that kind of interconnect for teenagers particularly. I think younger kids, parents still can enforce the discipline and stuff, but when they get to teenagers, it's a bit more problematic. The whole point of sleep is that you regenerate, restore kind of whatever's been burnt out during the day, you kind of fix it so that you wake up in the morning with no sleep debt and you can function properly during the day. That is the whole point of sleep. And if you're sleepy during the day, it's because you haven't had enough quantity or the quality. You've had enough quantity, but the quality is rubbish. So one of the two. So it's really quite simple. Like as a decider, like what's happening, it's very easy to see the kid who's only getting 4 hours of sleep. I think critical to the sleep issue is that there are basic tenets of sleep, and that is that you've got to be sleepy to be able to fall asleep. Like that's the key thing. And in teenagers, that drifts, that sleepiness that makes it easy to fall asleep drifts. So kind of at least an hour, about 14, 15-year-olds, at least an hour later. But the school, when it gets to the school holidays or it gets to an intensive study period, that they stay up a whole lot later than that, and it's 1, 2 o'clock in the morning before they're going to bed. And then holidays, I mean, we know teenage boys are staying up gaming till 2 in the morning. Parents are going, shame, it's the holiday, let them sleep till 10, 11 in the morning. And then school starts again, and they're stuck on another time zone. I mean, like really out. I mean, there's the 1 hour out, that's manageable. But when you're 4 hours out of the normal time zone and you only feel sleepy at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you can only fall asleep at 2, and then waking up at 6:30 is equivalent to being woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you feel awful. So parents are battling to get their kids out of bed in the morning, massive fights in the family to get this child out of bed. They're tired, but more than being tired, they feel physically ill. So their blood, I mean, at 4 o'clock in the morning, your blood pressure is low, your pulse rate is low, your gut is inactive. You should be asleep, like your whole body. So you essentially have jet lag. So they're waking up with jet lag. They're not hungry. They don't eat breakfast. And they're coming to school, and for the next 3 hours or until their natural wake-up time, which could be 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, that whole period, they are asleep. Functionally, they are asleep. They are awake, but they are non-functional. And so, you know, and that's often when schools go, no, maths, first period, because that's when you're awake. Oh, no, they're not. Like, routinely, they're not awake at 8 o'clock in the morning. So the sleepy kid is often, and in teenagers, that's the major problem that we have, is delayed sleep phase. So they are running 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. And when you talk to them, and what annoys me a little bit is I feel like I've spoken about this problem so many times to doctors that I kind of go, this is a big problem, right? You need to see it. And so many times I'm seeing patients and young patients who are really, really battling. And I'm asking them questions about, so are you sleepy when you go to bed at 10 o'clock? And they go, not at all. And I go, well, when are you sleepy? And they go, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. So I go, okay, so if you do fall asleep at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, how long can you sleep for? They go, oh, I can sleep till 11 in the morning, no problem. And I go, so if I told you that school was going to start at midday, would you have a sleep problem? And they go, no, I'd be fine. Okay, it is such an easy, it's just such an easy thing to diagnose because it's three questions, right? It's not high flung. You don't need sleep studies. You don't need blood tests. You don't need anything. It's about just talking to the kid and saying, what is happening with your sleepiness? Because if you're not sleepy at 10 o'clock at night and you're only sleepy at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's 4 hours early. Okay? So it's basically like us adults. If our bedtime is 11, it's us trying to go to bed at 7 o'clock at night. Okay? Like, you know, instinctively it's not going to work. Like, you know, you're not going to be able to fall asleep at 7 because your bedtime is actually at 11. But because it's displaced this 4 hours, they kind of don't see it the same way. And when I talk to teenagers often and their parents and then talk about delayed sleep phase syndrome and I say, does that sound like you? And they go, absolutely, that's me. And I kind of go like, why has nobody had this conversation with you before? because it's easy to diagnose. And once they know what it is, there's a huge pressure off. And you talk about medication. The medication doesn't work because you're taking it at 7 o'clock at night. Okay, no sleeping tablet's going to work if you take it at 7 o'clock at night and your bedtime's actually at 11.
Yeah.
What you end up doing is taking more and more meds to try and produce that sleepiness that's not there naturally. And these kids are often on masses of medication.
Yeah.
Like two or three, you know, tablets, transleep melatonin and an antidepressant, a sedating antidepressant, and a full-blown sleeping tablet, and this and the next thing. And they come with a history where they're saying the medications don't work. So they really get into a bad place in that they're kind of going, nothing works. Like, how do I manage this? Because nothing is working. Because all they get given is medication. That seems to be the only route that doctors kind of go for.
An interesting observation for me, and one of the reasons why this has been a question in my mind, I mentioned earlier that we're going on a camp. Of course, part of that is managing the medication of the kids.
Mm.
And it's the whole list of what happens in the morning and a whole list of what happens in the afternoon. And, you know, I need my, you know, the first night we're on camp, it's I need my pill to go to sleep at night. But by the second and third night, they're sleeping before the pill happens, mm-hmm. and they're waking up and things are happening normally. And we come back and we give them, and the mom says, but you didn't take the sleeping pill. We didn't need it.
Mm.
They've been active all day. They've been engaged. They are eating when they're meant to be eating. They're sleeping when they're meant to sleep. And they're physically active and engaged as well. And it just begs the question, is this necessary? They do take the ADHD meds in the morning, but it's worn off properly by the time that they've got to the evening sleep, and they are actually physically tired. Their bodies are going, we need to rest now.
Mm.
The other thing that I took away from our first conversation when we were talking about sleep hygiene and was quite serious was the wake-up time of a teenager's gut, which is delayed by an hour. Now, I start teaching the matrix at 9:30. And from that point onwards, I've said to them, they can eat while I'm busy teaching. Because they don't eat until that point. First break, they don't. But they'll start by eating and then they're nibble. And kids who are on ADHD meds often don't want to eat in that.
No.
But the reality is that we don't allow them to eat when they do feel hungry. So allowing the kids without, you know, we're not rustling papers and making a noise and distracting from learning. But if you're sitting chowing your sami or something while working, you're suddenly awake. You're feeding your gut. You're getting the energy when you need it. And it's made a much more peaceful teaching environment. The kids are more active and involved. And it was something that really stuck out to me.
Well, that's interesting that you did that.
Because I can't make them come to school later. But I acknowledge that they're only really waking up later.
Well, and I think that is important because there's a sense of you can only eat here and you can only eat there. And so some of the kids say that by the time they get to second break, for example, they are ravenous because they actually get hungry halfway between, like as you say, that 10 o'clock.
So I let them eat.
At a primary school level, this idea of you can't go to the bathroom now because you've just had break, especially for young girls, we're teaching them that they shouldn't listen to their bodies and their bodies are telling them something different to what the teacher is saying.
Mm.
So it's the same with eating. Is at a young age, from age of 7, we're saying, if you're hungry and you know you're hungry, let's go and eat. And then if you don't want to eat, then, well, maybe it wasn't hunger, it was something else. So then you're leaning into that, helping young children to understand themselves and respect what their body needs and get what they need.
Yeah.
I think it's really important from a sleep point of view as well.
Well, I mean, and it's always healthier to eat when you're hungry, not just eat when you're told to eat.
Yeah.
Okay, that's just a basic concept in nutrition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm from a mainstream high school. So we have a lot of children that abuse caffeine in terms of the Monster energy drinks, the Red Bulls. And I was reading journal articles today, and it's saying the increase of this caffeine into their little bodies produces actually poorer sleep or has an influence in the poor sleep patterns, right? Now you accompany that with your overuse of your devices or their devices and the blue lights and staying up later because of social activity or to finish up projects and studies. All of that in an average, if we can say, normal child can also present as ADHD symptoms because of the usage of that and the late bedtimes. So it's quite tricky, actually, when you're looking at a teenager. So I'm not talking about the small children presenting, but our teens, with all of this in mind, to now realize, are we dealing with an ADHD here or we're dealing with bad habits in terms of caffeine use, digital devices, late nights. So if you could just speak on that a little bit, I think lots of parents would be interested. Where do we look at ADHD and where do we look at teenage habits?
So I think my kind of motto is that no kid should be put on medication unless you've taken a really good history about their sleep. Like, you really need to understand that you're not dealing with a sleep problem. And I'm not saying that all ADHD is caused by sleep problems, not at all. But I'm saying that ADHD is made a lot worse if you have a sleep problem. So I think there is a thing called ADHD. I'm not trying to like usurp the whole thing. But if you have a sleep problem, it's definitely there. And I think that, well, I know that your average doctor doesn't have time to have that conversation often with teenagers. Often teenagers don't speak to doctors. They don't like doctors. So they don't want to give any information away that might mean they get more meds or anything like that. So, but it's a very important conversation because all of that affects sleep. So, and the interesting thing about caffeine, so let's deal with each of them. Let's look at caffeine first. So caffeine is very person specific. I am very sensitive to caffeine. Okay. So I cannot have any caffeine after like midday. Otherwise, it does affect my sleep. I go to bed and my head is like just jingling, okay, because of caffeine. So I need to be very careful. But I also understand there are other people who can drink as much caffeine as they like and it doesn't affect them. So I think you need to understand your own kind of body and how you respond to caffeine. But generally, the literature would say that the effects of caffeine last 6 hours. Okay, that's a long time and much longer than you think. So you already can have an awake brain before you even start trying to go to bed. Then when it comes to light, the important thing about light, really the only important thing about light, is what it does to melatonin. So the way that you fall asleep is that you're awake for long enough. That's the one biological force we call the homeostatic force. Basically says the longer you stay awake, the sleepier you get. It's pretty much that force. But then melatonin only gets produced in dim light. So you need to have this dim light in the evening and you produce melatonin. And what melatonin does is drop your body temperature. And then from that body temperature, all the other circadian rhythms kind of get linked onto that. So it really is absolutely fundamental to all of your body rhythms. And that includes everything. Everything has a low point and a high point during the day, and day or night, whether it's cortisol, whether it's potassium levels, whether it's how much urine the kidney produces. Everything has a circadian rhythm in the body. So all of that gets linked to this body temperature. And as the body temperature goes down, you feel sleepy. That's your sleepy thing. Okay. So generally what we try to do is have the amount of time you've been awake for tie in to your melatonin production so that they dovetail together and you get this nice big sleepy feeling and then you can fall asleep. So that's what we try to do. So if you don't have dim light, you don't produce melatonin or you produce less of it, okay? Which means that the sleepiness is not there when you want it. But it also means that if the first dim light that you have is when you switch off the light to go to sleep, then you start producing melatonin there and you're only going to be sleepy in an hour and a half. Now, an hour and a half of lying in bed, not feeling sleepy, is going to turn you into a crazy person. And that's where kids get massive anxieties about, because now I can't sleep, what am I going to do, blah, blah, blah. And so they get anxiety, they get depressed about the whole situation that they can't control their sleep. So it just spirals into this absolute nightmare of a situation. And then you get the situation added to that is, and it's not just teenagers, but it's people who work at night as well, is that sense that they do homework, hop past 10, switch off the light, expect to be asleep at 11. And you go, that's not going to happen. Okay. It's really just not going to happen. So you need to have a downtime. I think as a society, we've lost the concept of rest. Okay. So we go work, come home, have dinner, get children to bed, go to bed ourselves, and there's no rest. Does that make sense? Like just sitting and resting. So you need that rest. You need that rest to kind of get your head into a good space to be able to fall asleep. And then when you actually fall asleep, there are people who can just go put their head down and fall asleep like in 30 seconds. I'm not one of them. And I think that a lot of creative people can't switch their heads off, that it's harder for them to actually engage with that sleepiness. And so there are people who need to put in a very deliberate process to be able to fall asleep, be it reading, be it doing something, you know, else, or listening to a podcast or something, to engage that very logical side of your brain so that you can even feel the sleepiness, because otherwise your head is like just dodging it, you know, and you're not feeling sleepy at all. So when you do have, and look, there are people who can fall asleep. There are people who can work till 11 and fall asleep at 10 past 11. I understand that. And if you can do that, you're lucky. Okay. It's not a given that it's normal. It's not. There are lots of people who can't do it, and particularly kids. So if you have this propensity for children to run late at night, so they're going to run an hour late, what you don't want is to put a whole lot of things in place to push it even further later. Okay. So they're having caffeine. They are doing schoolwork right up until 11 o'clock and expecting to fall asleep at 10 past 11. They are anxious about their sleep. And then they're pushing their melatonin out because they're not allowing it to happen. So there is, it's a confluence of a whole lot of bad stuff that, that can happen together. And the particular problem with caffeine is if they are not sleeping well, they use more caffeine, and then they don't sleep well, and then they use more caffeine. And so, and what we need to remember about caffeine is that it's not just an anti-sleep thing. It pushes your heart rate up. It pushes the whole body. It's a whole body thing. And that's not healthy in the long term, to be taking a lot of caffeine.
I feel like our ADHD kids are the ones that sit in that bedtime refusal where they delay it, they push it out, they can't fall asleep easily. And maybe, I don't know if we can speak maybe on bedtime routine for ADHD in teenagers.
Well, I mean, bedtime routine is important for everybody. I mean, it really is important. I think it's particularly important for ADHD because they do struggle with focus at night particularly, because their meds have worn off. Okay.
And their brains are wired.
Their brains are wired. And I mean, there's an interesting discussion at one of the psychiatric conferences I was at where the question I got asked was, why do some kids sleep better if they take Ritalin at night? Okay, like before, and I went, well, that's an interesting question. But sometimes, because it helps them focus on bedtime. Okay, because they're not like all over the place. It helps them focus on what they need to do and that. But more importantly for me, the interest was, I mean, what Ritalin does, or methylphenidate, what it does is it increases dopamine levels in the brain. That's what it does. Well, guess what is caused by a drop in dopamine? Restless leg syndrome, which is much higher in kids with ADHD. So every single sleep disorder is higher in kids with ADHD. And so sometimes maybe what that's doing is it's actually treating the restless legs, and so it's easier for them to fall asleep. Okay, so that was very interesting when people said that. But if you have ADHD, routines are so important to put in place. But I do get it that parents, by the time the kids go to bed, I'm done fighting with these kids.
Absolutely.
Today. I'm just done. I don't want to fight about bedtime as well.
Mm.
But the important thing about that is that if you have the fight about bedtime, you theoretically get less fights the next day on everything else.
100%.
Okay.
You mentioned something. I just want to follow up on that. So you were talking about this ADHD stimulants. So I read that, and I wanted to get your professional opinion. In children samples, the stimulants disrupt sleep. But in adult samples, the stimulants help with sleep. But there's not much research around teenagers.
So what helps sleep at night? Or
yes. So in general sleep. So children on stimulants, it says in average it disrupts sleep more. In adults, it does help for sleep, but there was no research conclusive on teenage.
Yeah, no one does research on teenagers. Mm. Why is that? Because they're just difficult to do research on. No, they are. They are difficult to do research on because there's so much going on. And because there is no average 16-year-old, for example.
Puberty and hormones.
Yeah, and that happens at different times, and their growth spurts happen at different times. And I mean, we've all had the experience of having kids on medication. They have a growth spurt, and all of a sudden medication doesn't work. So you're having to change medications because of growth spurts. So they have different growth spurts, puberty at different times. So everything's kind of in flux during the teenagers. So you're right, there isn't much data on teenagers. I think in adults, if they the calmer they can be during the day, the easier it is for them to fall asleep. In kids, the medication is tricky because The long acting kind of medications, which is what they're usually taking, can be very long acting in kids and can continue to be working at night. And often parents are going, I prefer it working at night because then they're calm and focused and they'll do homework and they're not all over the place. So the ADHD, the combination of the ADHD treating the ADHD, but still allowing the kids to be able to fall asleep is a very tricky kind of thing to manage. But what we can't do is just take it in that one context and go, it's about the medication and about falling asleep. It's not just about that. There's so much else going on that we're not asking about. So the sleep apnea, the restless legs, the delayed sleep phase, the lights, the caffeine, the homework, the routines, the all of that has to be taken into account. And so I find that there tends to be a very one-sided conversation about meds and sleep. No. It's much bigger than that.
Well, imagine that humans were a complex system. So,
gosh, what a shock.
The Fireside Talk came at a very appropriate time because I have one particular client, grade 9, 15-year-old, female, who's in a high-achieving school and was diagnosed ADHD, autism last year, and the ADHD was before, as well as dyslexia. But recently she's been particularly struggling with sleep, and we've been having conversations about it, and I'm still in there trying to figure it out, and not everything can be discussed therapeutically, Some things are just like, what's really going on in terms of anxiety and biological levels as well. She's on medication, so it came up and I was kind of struggling with this particular client at the time. But in general, I've always been quite curious about sleep because you often find that neurodiverse individuals, including adults, have some kind of oddities in their sleeping patterns, whether ASD, ADHD.
It would be fascinating for us to, as professionals working with children, to say, if they slept well and were ready for the day, how much stuff disappears? How much anxiety, how much mood swings, how much depression, how much loss of appetite, how much goes away if we're sleeping well? It's the same kind of question. If you're sleeping well and eating well and exercising well, how much of a lot of this goes away and normalizes within what we consider to be a normal functioning bell curve?
I think the answer is to find those kids and accept that they have a sleep problem, right? And it's not just a feature of ADHD or a feature of autism. Does that make sense? So it's often it's a symptom of depression. It's a symptom of ADHD. It's a symptom of ASD. Well, maybe it's the thing. It's the thing.
Not the symptom.
Not just a symptom. Does that make sense? So that's what tends to happen is the psychiatrists kind of go, it's a symptom of depression. So that's why I have a talk for the psychiatrist. It's called, what if it's not depression? Like, could you think outside of your silo just for a moment? What if it's not depression? Because your patients get all the sleep disorders. They get sleep apnea. They get restless legs. They get everything else. Could you please ask the questions about their sleep and see sleep as possibly the thing?
And what if it's none of those things, but it's parents having dinner parties until 11 o'clock at night and 2 o'clock in the morning?
Oh, they're those things. Yes. But the point is the sleep is the thing. And those are called environmental causes of insomnia. So
it's such an easy place to start rather than medication.
The point is to have the conversation, to say to a teenager, tell me about your bedtime routine. Tell me what happens after dinner. What happens? Well, then I do this and then I do that. Tell me the times. What is happening? What is going on? So then I take my tablets and then I go to bed. Are you sleepy when you go to bed? No. Well, why do you go to bed? Because my mom tells me I have to go to bed. Okay, that's an instant red flag. You know, nobody can fall asleep if you're not sleepy. No medications work if you're not sleepy. Sleeping tablets work the best if you are sleepy and you just can't get over that edge. Just can't fall asleep. That's where sleeping tablets work the best. And if you have insomnia, they are the registered medication for that disorder. But if you're not sleepy, then you're asking that tablet to do everything, and it can't. And that's where things fall apart.
And that's when they don't work.
That's when they don't work. Yeah. And literally in hyphens, they don't work. Patients come and say, they've been on this. So anytime a patient comes to me, adult or kid, and they say, so I've been, here is the list of medications, that they come with a piece of paper. Here is the list of medications that I've tried. And I've gone, what works? They go, none of them. And I go, right. In my head, immediately, I'm going, you either have delayed sleep phase or you're naturally short sleeper. because those are two big groups where the medications don't work. And there's a lot of kind of hype about sleeping medications and they're addictive and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. Well, the deal is that there are three types of people who take sleeping tablets. They're the addicts, and they're addicts. And the sleeping tablets are the least of their problems. Okay. They'll take 15 sleeping tablets a day, but that's because they can't come down from their tuck and their cat and their whatever else they're taking. But the sleeping tablets are not the problem. So there are the addicts. Then there are the problem children, like these ones, where they don't work. The sleeping tablets are not working no matter what they try, no matter what combinations, how high they go. They just don't work. The majority of people who take sleeping tablets are taking low doses, sleeping very well, functioning very well during the day, and they are fine. And we should leave them alone. Okay, because they're fine. But these other two groups we need to worry about. Okay, sleeping tablets on their own are not addictive. They're not heroin, for goodness sake. And people generally are not addicted. Like, addiction has a very specific definition. You know, there's a compulsive drug seeking. There is a preference of the drug over job, school, life. You'll let your life fall apart for that drug. That is not your average person who takes a sleeping tablet, for heaven's sake. So we need to calm down about sleeping tablets. They may be the correct thing to use in the correct circumstances. But your teenager that is using them because they're coming down, trying to come off a caffeine high, not appropriate. Like, could we take away the caffeine because that makes more sense? But it does with teenagers particularly. So I get lots of reluctant 16-year-olds in my office with their mother or their father or somebody. And they, like, you know, they come in and they sit down with this like face and you go, oh, my boy, this is going to be a conversation. But if you actually treat them like adults and go, tell me about, mother tries to interrupt and I go, I'll come to you in a minute. Tell me about what's happening. And you just, how are you feeling at this point? What is happening? How is your sleep? Are you sleepy? When are you sleepy? And they kind of look at their mom and I go, tell me when you're sleepy. And they go, only at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And the mother's going, and I'm going, yeah, I understand that. I know exactly what you have. And they kind of go, really? And I go, yeah, I know what you have. I said, you have jet lag. And then I have this conversation about if school started at 12, would you have a problem? And they go, no, I wouldn't have a problem. Mom's sitting there, no one's asked. No one's spent the time with this kid and asked them about this kind of stuff. So it is that conversation that needs to happen. So if you have a kid who's sleepy, you've got to have that conversation with them because you get pointers. The other question you have to ask them is, do you ever have a funny feeling in your legs? Like, you've got to move them at night. You can't lie still. They'll either look at you like you're crazy or they'll go, yeah, I have that. If you've had it for long enough, you think it's normal. You will never actually tell somebody you have it. I diagnose restless legs all the time in patients who have seen umpteen psychiatrists, umpteen doctors about their insomnia. And I say, has anyone asked you about your legs before? And they go, no one's ever asked. They have full-blown restless leg syndrome. That's why they can't fall asleep. We put them on meds and they sleep. Okay. So you've got to have that conversation. As I say, you've got to say, maybe sleep is the thing. And let's have a conversation just about sleep, not about everything else. Just about sleep, because then you find it and you see the big sleep disorders. And the point is, all of the big sleep disorders can be treated. They all cause attention deficit during the day, because that's the whole thing about sleep. Long before you feel sleepy during the day, you have this massive loss of executive functions. So thinking innovatively, thinking laterally, knowing where you are in a sequence, everything that makes us different to chimpanzees is what you lose first. Long before you're tired, but long before you actually fall asleep. Yeah. So kids who fall asleep in class are way past that. Does that make sense? Like, they've had it for a while when they're actually falling asleep in class. But it is about parental routines. It is about being a parent, not being your kid's best friend. It is about saying to your kid, you're going to bed now. Like, I have vivid memories of carrying my youngest daughter, who's 6 years younger than the oldest and had to go to bed earlier. Vivid memories of carrying her down the passage, her screaming at me, telling me I was the worst parent in the world. I went, yep, that, we'll deal with that tomorrow, but right now you're going to bed because it's bedtime. You've got to be a parent. You have to put your kid to bed.
And there's got to be space in your house for your child.
There has to be space, yes.
Which is bedtime routine. There's space for that.
But I mean, you think about it, we're very lucky. I mean, in the spaces that we work and the kind of the people that we work with, that they have special rooms for their kids. Mm. The vast majority of the world doesn't have a special room for the kid. The kid just has to sleep where everything else is happening, right? Where parents are still awake, where maybe the older sibling is trying to study in one room or two rooms max. That's all you have for your house. And I think we kind of normalize upper class, middle class sleep. Okay. Whereas normal is actually not that at all. I mean, having more than one room in your house is not normal. It's actually super, super above normal. Normal is much more everyone sleeps in the same bed, okay, because you only have money for one bed and you only have room for one bed and you only have room for everyone in one or two rooms. That is much more normal in the world than the way we have it, where we have separate bedrooms for children.
So talk to that more in terms of normal, because there would be the ideal sleeping arrangement, this idea of my young kid is still sleeping in my bed with me, the controversy around that. So you're saying normal in terms of it's happening more often, or normal in terms of that would be a great normal way for your child to fall asleep?
Well, I mean, normal is a big perception thing, like what normal sleep is. So I'm going to take you back to the 1500s in England, okay? The literature we have about the 1500s is that you went to work, which was always in the fields, because that's what everybody did, right? Then you would come home, you would wash, you would have like English tea in a sandwich, and you'd go to sleep because you're tired. So you'd sleep, go to sleep at 7, and it's dark, okay? So you'd go to sleep at 7 and you'd wake up at 11. Everyone would wake up at 11. The whole community was awake between 11 and 2, put the fires on, have dinner, have a big communal time, and then go back to sleep at about 2 o'clock in the morning. So sleep was biphasic to these two pieces. Because there's a lot of literature about it's easier to conceive children at midnight. God hears prayers at midnight. We're going, who the hell's awake at midnight, you know, for all of this stuff to happen? Well, the answer was everybody was awake. And it's an interesting concept, as in the conversations that people would have after you've had 4 hours of sleep, after your busy day, would be very different to the way we do it, where we're having conversations at the end of our busy day, right? When we're tired, okay? So biphasic sleep was a thing for millennia. Honestly, millennia, right? As long as humans have been humans, we've had this biphasic sleep because it just made sense. When we got control of light, we shifted that first phase to touch the second phase. And so we have these two phases now sitting over here. If you extend the time that you spend in bed, it splits at exactly that point. So 3 hours into your sleep, that's where it splits. So people who have insomnia who are going to bed too early, we'll say they sleep for 3 hours and they wake up and they've got 2 hours awake in the middle of the night. And then they sleep for another couple of hours. And I go, well, you know, in 1500s, that would be normal. Okay, that wouldn't. But what we do is, because we think that normal is the solid 8 hours of sleep, it's not solid to begin with, but that solid 8 hours of sleep is normal. Okay, well, it's only been normal for about 500 years. Okay, the other 3,000 years or 7,000 years we've been around wasn't normal at all. So normal is a perception thing. I have a patient who sleeps biphasic and has this section in the middle of the night, and he says he loves it. He says he does, he's Phil Collins for an hour in the middle of the night. So I said, I hope you use electronic drums with headphones. He goes, yeah, but he drums for an hour in the middle of the night because he's awake and it just fills his soul with joy. And I said, so do you want to lose this hour? He goes, hell no. Like, I love this. And we have elderly patients who do that. So they have, their children are in Australia. So they wake up at midnight and have an hour's conversation with them because that suits
them. But how beautiful to normalize that, exactly. Especially for elderly patients.
Exactly. So the normal thing is very tricky because it's a social construct, actually. It's how social has decided that this is what sleep is going to be, because the minute we could control light, we stayed up instead of going to bed early at 7. Mediterranean countries have a biphasic sleep. They have 2 hours of siesta in the middle of the day because, why? It's too hot to do anything. So let's go sleep for 2 hours and then everyone stays up until midnight. I mean, kids go to bed at 10, 11 at night because they've had 2 hours of sleep during the day. So if you told them that that was abnormal, they'd go, we've been doing this for centuries. Like, what do you mean abnormal?
I'm going to turn my aftercare into 2 hours of sleep. It's going to be the easiest thing to manage.
Yes, it is, absolutely, because that's where we have another dip in our body temperature, is in the afternoon. So 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, all of us have a dip. We all know we have a dip. We all know that after lunch we kind of go, maybe I'll just delete emails right now because my head is not in the game. Yeah, it is. It's not a great time. But then, and particularly in teenagers, young people, they get this big high after that, and then they're awake. I mean, I remember reading a book about sleep written by Bill Dement. Now, Bill Dement is like one of the gods of sleep. I mean, he's one of the first people to do research on sleep. He's passed away now, but, you know, right up until his 80s, he was still busy doing research, being interested. And then talking about having postgraduate students working with him and expecting them to be in at 8 in the morning and finish at 5 in the afternoon. And he looked at this and he went, why am I doing this? You know, like, this doesn't make any sense. So he said, right, from now on, your working hours are 11 until 8. He said, the amount of work that got done was astronomically higher than expecting them to work at 8 when they were non-functional, basically, and stopping at 5 when they hit their high. They hit their high performance at 5. And so he just let them work whenever they wanted to. And he said, astronomical amount of work got done because you're now working according to your rhythms. It brings in the larks and the owls. Okay. Like, I went through med school with everyone telling me to wake up at 4 and study. And I would wake up at 4 and 5 past 4 and 10 past 4 and 15. There's no way I can wake up at 4. But I can stay awake till 2 in the morning and study. No problem whatsoever. They couldn't. Okay. So you do get larks who have to be in bed early, but they're up at 4. Okay. And they can function very well early in the morning. And then the owls, which are the lesser of the delayed sleep phase syndromes, they're not quite problematic. But I'm an owl. I can't fall asleep before 11:30. My sweet time to wake up in the morning is 6:45. I don't see patients before 9. Because there's no point. It spoils my day to wake up early in the morning. But I often work until 10:30 at night, work. And then I stop work at 10:30. And then there's a downtime. I have to have a downtime. So I faff around, you know, and I get the kitchen sorted and do some bits and stuff. And then 11 o'clock I go to bed and I have a very kind of set routine. And then at 11:30, I'm out. And then naturally wake at 6:30 in the morning. And because I can now, because I don't need to get your kids to school, I'm very functional. And that's my best way to sleep, in order that I get enough sleep and in order that I can get the work done that I need to get done. I mean, people kind of talk about 9 o'clock, they get ready for bed. I go 9 o'clock, I go, okay, open the laptop. What am I going to do tonight? Okay. And you can't fight that. If you fight that, you're kind of putting yourselves at behind all the time. And you kind of go like, that's the best way that I function. Well, then that's what you should do. And that's how you should work.
In the beginning, we actually said that teenagers are staying up late to finish work or to socialize, etc. And then if school had to start later in the day, they'd function so much better. Mm. But now societal norms doesn't allow that in our country, right? So now we are forcing them to go to school super early. They still staying up late. Mm. So how do you explain to parents that, you know, so parents obviously, they have to go to school at a certain time. Mm. They sometimes dropped off at 6 a.m. Mm. The poor child's not okay. But how do we actually adapt this now? Because that's the time school starts.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've done studies where they've taken, in the US, where they've taken whole schools and moved them later and shown that everything works better except the parents' bitch, because the parents can't get to work on time. So it's not just a schooling system. It's the whole corporate environment that doesn't allow it. Okay, so it's a much bigger problem than just moving schools, and so it is tricky. But I think you brought up the issue about melatonin and parents being worried about melatonin. It was you. Mm-hmm. So melatonin is an interesting thing. So we know that the melatonin shifts. It's a biological shift. It's not their fault. It happens in all kids that their melatonin shifts, and particularly in your neurodivergent kids.
What do you mean it shifts?
So it goes an hour later.
Is that around puberty?
Around puberty. So 15, 14, 16-year-olds, it literally biologically shifts. It's been shown in many, many studies that it's a biological thing that happens. It's not because of them staying up late. The delayed sleep phase, when it's 2 o'clock in the morning, that's different. But in every kid, it gets later. So it shifts by an hour.
So melatonin is a hormone?
It is.
What about estrogen and progesterone and oxytocin? How does that?
So estrogen, progesterone are all good for sleep. So that's why you get problems in menopause, because you lose those protective hormones about sleep. So they're all good for sleep. So, but you do get changes. I mean, all of that. That's what I was saying. This is a complex being, because you get puberty happening, and then you kind of go like, what are those? how is that interacting when you have kids who then get put on oral contraceptives, for women, young girls who get put on oral contraceptives because their periods are very irregular or their periods are very dense or whatever reasons are, how is that adapting all of that? You're right. All of that can factor into that. But when it comes to sleep, it's like melatonin we look for because that's our big sleepy hormone. But in your neurodivergent kids, we know, we have good data to say that they do not produce good melatonin. They don't. And so the main reason why your autism spectrum disorder kids don't sleep well is because they have low melatonins. And actually replacing melatonin, I mean, you've got to kind of work on a basis that if you have a hormone that is made in the body, some people don't have good enough. Like, some people don't have enough thyroid hormone. Some people don't have this. You just got to go with it. Some people don't have enough. So we know there are categories of people who don't have enough. So people with dementia have much worse melatonin than their elderly counterparts. If you go to ICU, you have no melatonin. It's gone because you don't have day and night. If you have light and dark happen in a hospital, you have better healing. You have better sleep. You are less likely to go out of the hospital with a sleep disorder. And we know that sleep deprivation has a big impact on immune function, for example. So if you don't sleep well in ICU and you get an infection, you're more likely to die. Okay, because you don't heal. Your immune function goes. And so, I mean, they did this fascinating study where they took college students and they put them in an ICU environment. Like, here's an ICU, you're going to sleep here now. Normal kids, you're now going to sleep in an ICU environment within a week. You couldn't measure their melatonin. It was gone because it was just...
Within one week.
Because they just have light all day. Mm. So it's all day light. It's just all day. They don't have a clear night. And you're also in an ICU where people die in the middle of the night. That's what happens. So it must be terrifying to be in ICU, to be shrouded off and just hear chaos happening. Okay? The number of people who have PTSD about COVID, or being in COVID wards... And the next morning, waking up, and people were just missing. They had just died in the middle of the night. So your sleep is critical to your... So poor sleep, you're more likely to catch cold, you're more likely to get pneumonia, you're more likely... If you have a vaccination and you're not sleeping well, you don't have the same antibody response. So we're talking about massive compromise here for sleep. It's not just about not being able to cope during the day. You're more likely to be absent if you have a sleep disorder. You're more likely to have... what's called presentism, okay? Like the kids, I'm there, but my brain is really not here. Like, you can see me, but this is all that's happening, okay? Yeah. So that happens in the workplace. It happens in schools. It happens all over the place. So it's such a much bigger problem than just I can't fall asleep at night. Does that make sense? So we know that back to the conversation about the neurodivergent kids, we know that there's good data that they have low melatonin and they should all be on melatonin if they don't sleep well. They should all be on melatonin because you're simply replacing a hormone that is not there.
And side effects of synthetic melatonin?
Zero. So melatonin is one of the safest drugs, it really is, that you can possibly take. So to give you an idea, during COVID, they looked at melatonin as an immune modulator. Because it is. Melatonin does a whole bunch of other stuff apart from sleep. So it's a free radical scavenger, picks up all the rubbish in your brain, clears out your brain, does a whole bunch of stuff.
Your own melatonin does it.
So, and part of this conversation is about neurodegenerative diseases, partly because you lose your melatonin as you get older, and so you don't have this flushing system that you have in the brain anymore. And so your brain kind of ages faster than something else. So, and when they were using it as an immune modulator, they were using 30 milligrams a day. Okay, now circadian, which is our melatonin, there's 2 milligrams. Okay, 30 milligrams a day, no side effects. They tried to do a lethal dose of melatonin in rats.
Couldn't kill them.
Okay, couldn't kill them. So do people get side effects? Yes. I mean, it's not side effect immune. So some people get nightmares on melatonin because the melatonin we have is a prolonged release, which tries to mimic your natural melatonin thing. Sometimes people still wake up groggy in the morning because it's lasting too long. Then you just chew it, okay? So you just chew it and it's fast release and then you don't get the dozy feeling in the morning. But most people take melatonin. The biggest problem people will say is melatonin doesn't work. Okay, that's the biggest problem. Yeah. They say it doesn't work. And I go, well, what are you expecting it to do precisely, right? Because it's not a sleeping tablet, right? It's not going to knock you out. Okay, you take a zolpidem, you are just going to be awake and then asleep, and you're not even going to know you've fallen asleep, right? That's what sleeping tablets do. Melatonin doesn't do that. What it does is replace this biological rhythm that you don't have. It's a subtle effect. Okay, you take it here. An hour and a half later, you're going to feel sleepy.
It's more of a supplement than it is a medication.
Yeah, it's more. And the point is, what we're trying to do is enhance your natural melatonin rhythm so that you can feel the sleepiness so that you can fall asleep. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You also can't give it at 7 o'clock at night. So generally, people who get given melatonin are told to take it an hour and a half before bedtime. Well, you can't just randomly pick any bedtime. Okay. Because if you ran, I want to fall asleep at 9, so I'm going to take it at 7:30. And your natural sleepiness is 1 in the morning. I have this cartoon of the brain going, cute, fascinating. What do you want to do with that? Like, that's not going to do anything. But magically, if your sleep is at 1 o'clock in the morning and you take it so that you're sleepy at 12, guess what? It works. Because you're close to your natural rhythm. So the delayed sleep phase syndromes, that's what we do. Those kids, we go, when's your natural sleepy time? 1 o'clock. So let's move you to 12. We can't move you much more than an hour. We move you to 12, so you're going to take your melatonin at 10:30, and you're going to take 2 tablets, and you're going to chew them. Why? Because I want to squash your natural melatonin, which is over here. I want that to stop. Move it to here. Let's get you to sleep at 12. You're going to wake up 7 hours later. You're going to have lots of light, and you're going to hate me, and I don't care, because I'm not in your bedroom, and your parent is, okay? But you're going to get up, and you're going to go have breakfast outside, or you're going to go for a walk, or you're going to just open the curtains, or on the drive to school, you're not going to wear sunglasses. That's going to happen because light is the break for sleep. So we pull the sleep with the melatonin in front and we break it with light. If you're in Scandinavia, you have to go and buy a light box. Mm. Okay, in South Africa, we have light every morning. We're lucky. And so we do that at 12 o'clock. We do that for 4 days. Sometimes we add a sleeping tablet to force the sleep there. And then we go, right, another hour, 4 days. Another hour, 4 days, and then we get them back to where they need to be. So the point about delayed sleep phase syndrome, it can be treated really well. Do teenage boys love routine? No. Do I care? No. Because that's how what they need to do. And I'd say to the parents, you've got to do this. And often the parents go, and I say to the kids, here's the good news. You can stay up till 1 o'clock right now. Like, don't even bother trying to fall asleep at 10. And they go, yes. And I go, here's the bad news. It's not going to last. Okay? It's not going to last. You've got to get up in the morning. So enjoy it for now. And we pull you back there and get you back into the right time zone. And then we keep them on melatonin for a while. What's a while? I don't know. 3 months, 6 months. Do I care? No. Kids are sleeping. And then we take away the melatonin. We go, hopefully your own melatonin comes back in the right place now. And then we get them off the melatonin. It's a short-term treatment, but it is a treatment. I think previously, up until about 8 years ago, melatonin was over the counter. You could just get it everywhere. And then it was taken off the shelves. And I think it was taken off, I have no proof, but I think it was taken off because the company registered Circadin with Sapra, got it registered. And melatonin, if you look in the old MIMS, kind of things that we have for medications, it was always registered as Schedule 4, i.e. on script. It was always a Schedule 4. But nobody noticed and nobody cared because it came in as a supplement and nobody really cared. And then when they wanted to register it, it kind of everyone went, oh, it's Schedule 4. Oh, interesting. Okay, we've got to take it off the shelves now. Now we know.
So it's less accessible.
So it's much less accessible now.
Good thing or bad thing?
It's a good thing. So there's very few countries in the world where it's over the counter. One of them is the USA. And there's a lot of concern about kids who are taking 10 milligrams a night. Okay, every night for the rest of their lives, because the parents can't be bothered to do the discipline, to do the routines, to do that kind of stuff. So let's just take melatonin. Can't be harmful. It's over the counter, right? Well, we have no idea what it's doing. We don't have any studies that say if you give a kid melatonin, as opposed to a replacement, so as opposed to your autistic kids who have low melatonin and you're just topping it up, that's all you're doing, right? That's different. So just like if you have a low thyroid and you just top it up till normal, that's good. But if you take extra thyroid, you're going to have problems, right? So the same thing, we have no studies that say what happens if you take too much melatonin for 10 years. No studies at all to say what happens. We know in animals it's involved in hibernation and estrus cycles and reproductive cycles and that kind of thing. You kind of go like, is it affecting kids? Like, we don't know. We don't have data. But just because we don't have data doesn't mean it's not doing anything, right? So you do need to treat it with caution. It is a medication. It is not just a plant, okay? It is medication. You need to treat it carefully, and you need to use it in the right circumstances. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then you get stuck into this thing of, well, melatonin doesn't work. We'll have to use something bigger than that. So an antidepressant or a sleeping tablet or something like that. And there's a reason why it doesn't work, because you're not you're asking it to do the wrong thing.
Out of the children that come and see you, I read that up to 50% are ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Are the stats that high? Is that what you actually see?
So it's tricky, because I tend to be the last resort of this, you know, a whole bunch of other doctors. So I do see a lot of kids with ADHD. I see a lot of adults who've been diagnosed with ADHD as well. And because they're difficult, and I tend to see the difficult patients. So they'll go to a psychiatrist, the psychiatrist will go, I'm done. And then I don't know what to do. And I do think the psychiatrist sit there and go, oh, hang on, this is a sleep problem. Oh, I can send them to Alison. Cool. Like, off my hands, like, go see Alison. You know, that kind of thing. So I do see complex kids with complex disorders.
Is there a strong prevalence, though? ADHD plus sleep disorders.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the literature, and the literature supports that as well.
Yes.
So, and
I just wanted to see if you see it in reality.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. I definitely see it. Yeah. The literature definitely supports that kids with ADHD, much higher prevalence of all of the sleep disorders, the full-blown sleep disorders, the restless legs, sleep apnea, all of those things, much higher prevalence in ADHD. And it's often hidden. So the restless legs thing is interesting, because I get lots of kids and I ask them about restless legs, or teenagers and young people, I ask them about restless legs. And they go, but I bounce my foot like this. Is that restless legs? And I go, and they go, I'm doing it right now. I go, well, stop it and tell me what you feel like. Okay. And they sit and they go, no, it feels fine. I go, then you don't have restless legs. Okay. But if they sit there and they go, please let me move it again. Please let me move. Please let me move. That's restless legs.
Mm-hmm.
That urge to move, like you cannot sit still. And they'll often say to me, isn't it a symptom of ADHD?
Exactly.
And I go, no. Okay. They say, isn't it a symptom of anxiety? And I go, no. They go, isn't, and I go, no, it's a real thing. Okay. It's a thing on its own. It's not a thing of other things. Okay. Restless leg syndrome is a thing. 10% of the Caucasian population have restless leg syndrome. Okay. The data on sleep apnea in adults in South Africa, we don't have data in children. Data in sleep apnea in adults, 23% of the population, the adult population, have moderate to severe apnea. Why? Because obesity is rising. Okay. Obesity in kids, start to get sleep apnea. Because we're not taking tonsils and adenoids out as we used to. So in my age group, you had 3 episodes of tonsillitis and your mother said, take the damn things out. And everyone had their tonsils and adenoids out. Now, certainly in the US, in like even 15 years ago, the only reason you could get tonsils and adenoids out was to prove they had sleep apnea. So you had this bizarre situation. I would go to these conferences and talk about pediatric sleep apnea, and they'd show these pictures of these massive big tonsils at the back of the throat. And they go, and then we did a sleep study. I'm going, why are you not taking the tonsils out? Like, I don't understand. So let's spend $600 on a sleep study to show that they have obstruction so that legally you can take the tonsils out, right? So it's switched around, and so we're not noticing the apnea in kids because the tonsils and adenoids are still there. 90% cure rate if you take out tonsils and adenoids. Yeah. Another quick question. Do kids snore? Do you snore? Shouldn't snore.
Shouldn't snore.
Shouldn't snore.
Should nobody be snoring?
No. Adults are different, but kids, no, kids should snore. So the interesting thing is, if you look at apnea in adults, up to 5 apneas an hour is normal. Okay, we wouldn't even worry about it. We go, it's noise pollution, do you need the noise fixed? 5 to 15 is mild sleep apnea. In kids, in primary school children, up to the age of 16, I think 16 is where they switch over to adult kind of criteria. But under that, 2 apneas per hour is normal. 5 apneas per hour is mild sleep apnea. 10 is moderate and 15 is severe. So the criteria are completely different for kids. And so if kids are snoring, they've likely got some apnea. And if they have apnea, their sleep is being fragmented. They're waking up tired in the morning. Parents are going, it's because you're staying up late at night, or it's because you're on your screens that you're tired in the morning. I'm going, no, they actually have apnea. Okay.
So you mentioned melatonin shifts by particular hours around 10 years. Did you say 1 hour?
About an hour.
About an hour. Okay, so that's around like 15, 16.
So it's in that 14 to 16-year-old kind of age group. I think it depends on puberty and growth spurts and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, because they're different. But it's around that kind of time. But it can happen much earlier and it can happen much later. So it happens in adults if they do stupid things like work all day and try and do an MBA.
Which is many adults.
More common. I know it is. I know it is. But the point is that you're studying till like 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, right? And then you're trying to sleep and you can push your whole sleep out. It happens in everyone who runs a restaurant or works in a restaurant. Anyone who works in the theater industry. All those things that like you have to stay up late at night or early in the morning to actually do what you need to do. They all have this problem. In fact, I believe that people who have delayed sleep phase syndrome choose to do those occupations because they can stay up. Your larks who need to go to sleep at 9 o'clock, they would never work in a restaurant ever. Yeah. They're the people who work in gyms. Okay, so they're there at 5 o'clock in the morning to open the gym so that everyone can go to the gym. They're the people who do that. But you do get people who select jobs because of how bad their sleep is.
I was in the hotel industry. I left it because I'm an early bird.
No, you couldn't go. No.
Night shifts killed me. Okay, but what I wanted to ask is maybe a very complex case, but a friend of mine, 38, but he seems to have all of it. I think he has to take his tonsils out. I think he has sleep apnea, and neurodivergent presenting. I think he's going for like an assessment soon. So potentially like autism related. But then he also says that like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up as like a routine. But particularly feels very depressed around that time. Any other time of day, like no other thoughts like that. But around that time in particular. So then when he saw the neurodivergent specialist, she mentioned something around potential sleep happening, things that could be causing that. So I'm just wondering, is there anything around like what could happen in the middle of the night, larks and mood or something along those lines?
Sleep apnea happens. That's what happens in the middle of the night. So often you get a presentation. So, I mean, sleep apnea, get everyone on the same page. So it's a collapse that happens at the back of the throat. So the throat just collapses in on itself, can't move air. And so your oxygen starts to drift down. At some point, 10 seconds later or so, your brain goes, you better wake up, otherwise we're going to die. So you wake up, whole thing opens up, lots of snorting and moving in bed and stuff. And then if everything's exactly the same, you have the same thing again. So, and that can go, I write reports on a weekly basis for people who are doing that 70 times an hour. Okay. So massive numbers. So you just multiply that up per hour of sleep. So 8 hours of sleep, even at 50 times per hour, that's 400 times that you get woken up during the night. Now, they will never be aware of all of those wake-ups. They might be aware of one or two of them. They very rarely wake up gasping, like that kind of sense. They very rarely wake up like that. But what they often wake up with is the consequence of that. So that happens. There's this adrenaline surge. And then they wake up with that adrenaline surge. So they'll often wake up saying, I wake up and my heart is beating and I feel anxious and I'm like, what just happened? Like, I feel like I had a panic attack while I was asleep. Okay? And I say, yeah, it's the adrenaline surge that happens at the end of the apnea, which causes all of the long-term consequences, cardiovascular, metabolic, et cetera, et cetera. So all of those consequences down the road is because of that adrenaline surge, which should not be happening at night while you're asleep. And so you can get those kind of things. You wake up and you go, I feel awful. Like, why do I feel so just awful? It can be from that. So, I mean, if he has, and again, the neurodivergent adults and kids, much more likely to have sleep apnea, restless legs, the whole bank sheet as well. So if he does have apnea, then we've got to look at that as being, that's his symptom, that he wakes up with that. And I don't think you were here when we were talking originally, like how sleep apnea can present so differently in different people. That in women, it doesn't present traditionally at all. 40% of women have not a single traditional symptom of sleep apnea, but they still have sleep apnea. So we kind of would look at that and go, are you snoring? So do you snore? Has anyone seen you stop breathing? So we have this thing called stop bang that we use. So we kind of snoring, tiredness, observed apneas, high blood pressure, BMI over 30, age over 50, neck circumference, and gender being male. 5 out of 8, 80% chance you have apnea. Like, it's really, it's really a good screening tool to like look at those things and do you have sleep apnea. So if he does wake up in the morning and there's in the middle of the night and there's any kind of sense that he has sleep apnea, it's too easy. You get a home test, like you get tested at home, and then you know if you have apnea or not. And if you have apnea and you treat the apnea, guess what? All of that goes away, and you live a healthier and longer life.
And then I've just heard of like lots of things on the market. Okay, there's melatonin, then there's GABA. There's
so much stuff.
There's like lots of stuff, you know. Yeah.
There are a lot of supplements. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So magnesium does seem to work, does seem to make people less anxious. It does seem to improve sleep. There's data on that. We have data on magnesium. The different magnesiums are just different absorptions, and so you get better absorption of one than the other. But also what I find with supplements is people go, so if one magnesium works, then two must be better, right? No, because again, you can't take these things in excess because they do have consequences. You can't take hundreds of magnesium tablets because there are consequences to high magnesium in the body. So the problem is that people go down that route. So GABA, people kind of go, well, I'm going to take GABA because GABA is the neurotransmitter that all the sleeping tablets target. Okay, it's the big inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. And so if you target GABA, you target GABA with every anesthetic, alcohol, barbiturates, sleeping tablets, all of those things target GABA and depress the brain. So kind of if I take GABA, then it'll work there. Well, not really, hey, because the brain is extraordinarily good at keeping stuff out of the brain. So just because you eat GABA, understand, you take it in, the first place it goes to is the liver. The liver chows, I don't know, a percentage of it, just chows it up because that's what the liver does. And then you have this percentage now in the blood, and then it gets to the brain, and the brain goes, I don't need you. So cheers. It doesn't get into the brain necessarily. It's actually very difficult to get medication into the brain because the brain has this blood-brain barrier and says, I don't need you in here. Thank you very much. We'll protect the brain. Of course, all the good stuff gets in. Alcohol, drugs, all of that stuff gets in. Okay. So all of that stuff gets in because it just does, right? That's why people drink alcohol, because it gets in the brain, right?
Because it works.
Because it works. But it's extraordinarily hard, for example, to get antibiotics into the brain. Like really hard. You have to have meningitis, i.e. the blood-brain barrier breaks down to actually get antibiotics in there, right? So it's really hard to get it in. And then people go, well, I'll take tryptophan because that's the precursor to serotonin. Yeah, same thing. The brain has like a little proteins that transport the tryptophan across the brain. It goes, I don't need any of you. I've got plenty. Thanks. So it doesn't get in. So all of these things kind of work, all right? But they kind of don't. Does that make sense? So it's the data. And as a doctor, I'm obliged to practice evidence-based medicine and to use only evidence. So the evidence does not support the use of anything except magnesium. And we don't want to go down the alcohol route. And I think it's scary how many teenagers go down the alcohol route as well. And some of them are using it to help them sleep.
Yep.
They honestly, it just knocks them out, and that's what they do. So we need to be careful about judging them for that as well, because if they're not getting managed well by their doctors, they will use whatever they have in the cupboard. And that's just what they do. And alcohol and cannabis is the other thing that they use. Both work extraordinarily well to help you sleep. But if you're worried about getting tolerant to sleeping tablets, you get tolerant to those a hell of a lot faster, like much faster, very tolerant. Obviously have lots of other consequences than sleeping medication does. And in fact, cannabis works so well for insomnia that one of the big reasons why people keep going back onto cannabis is because when they come off, they have 45 days of insomnia before it resolves.
Mm.
And of course, everyone they go and see goes, no, because you're like an addict, we're not going to give you sleeping tablets. So they don't get treated properly. And then within like 2 weeks, they're going, I can't stand this, back on the cannabis, because now at least I can sleep. Okay. So cannabis is a problem. CBD doesn't work. I mean, so doesn't work for insomnia itself. Works for anxiety, works for pain. And if you have insomnia because of either of those two, it'll work. But it doesn't, the data on all of the cannabinoids when it comes to sleep and sleep disorders is that there are interesting preliminary results. Okay, so we know there's a cannabinoid that works for sleep apnea in some people. We know there's a cannabinoid that works for restless legs. I have patients who use cannabis for restless legs. Cannabis, not CBD, cannabis. So I have one patient who's every so often sends me this text message. And she goes, so here's what I'm taking. Can I have another script, please? And I go, I can give you everything except the cannabis. She takes a small puff of cannabis, which helps restless legs. It does. So you can understand why somebody would take cannabis and go, oh, I sleep a whole lot better. Let me just carry on doing this because I'm not getting what I need from the medical profession. But this works. But there are massive consequences to that.
I was just wondering about challenges that parents may have when it comes to good sleep hygiene. And if they even know if their teens are getting enough sleep. Mm. Because we have these little guys that we take everywhere with us. And even adults with a fully developed brain struggle to switch off when they start scrolling or when they start watching a Netflix series. So I was wondering, have you seen cases where parents have challenges with that?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time because often parents aren't educated on sleep either. So they're kind of going, bedtime needs to be 10 o'clock, okay? And so they enforce that. And if you have a kid who can't sleep, what's the kid supposed to do? So they will go onto their phones because they're lying in bed there. If they don't do anything, their head goes into crazy land, which is everybody does. It's not just teenagers. The worst thing you can do if you can't sleep is lie in bed and try to sleep.
Yeah.
Because within 15 seconds, you're going, what can I do about the war in Gaza? You know, like, how do I deal with that? You're kind of going like, actually nothing, so calm down. But, and then it's about, I can't sleep, and why can't I sleep? And then, so people get extraordinarily anxious lying in bed trying to fall asleep. So to avoid that, and it's a conversation I often have with teenagers where they kind of go, I'm super anxious, and that's why I can't sleep. So I go, right, let's walk through that. Tell me about your routine. Okay, and they go to bed at 10. Are you tired? No. Are you anxious? No. Okay, so what happens then? Well, then I lie in bed and get super anxious. So I said, so what you're telling me is that the anxiety comes because you can't sleep. And they go, yeah, actually, so it's that way around. Okay. There are anxious kids. There are. And that's different. But most of them are getting anxious because they can't sleep. And that's the anxiety. It's very specific about sleep. And it's valid. It's not invalid. I mean, generalized anxiety disorder is an invalid anxiety. I'm just anxious about everything. These are kids who just are anxious about their sleep. So if you have parents who kind of go, that's what's going to happen, you're going to go to sleep at 10 because I feel I need to be, as a parent, trying to induce good sleep habits because that's what they know. But you have a kid with a problem. Parents don't know they have a problem. They honestly don't know they have a problem because they hide it. The kids hide it, and all they know is the kids are tired when they wake up in the morning. And often I will have teenagers who are telling me stuff and the parents have no idea that's happening. So I'm watching these two people and the teenager's telling me and the parents going, and I'm going, relax, mom, relax. It's important that I get this information.
Yeah.
And I understand you don't know this, and I understand that's horrifying for you, but I need to get this information because the only way I can help your child is that I know everything. Okay. And so I say to the kid, you need to tell me the truth. Like, otherwise, this is a waste of time. Right. So you need to tell me the truth. So that's often not about illegal drugs, and it's not that kind of stuff. It's just this kid can't sleep. So they do get on their phones, and I think. And the parents are trying to do the right thing. So parents are kind of going, I can't believe I was... And often when we talk about delayed sleep phase syndrome, and that's what they have, parents are going, I can't believe that I was trying to force you to go to sleep. Like the parents are kind of going, I'm really sorry like that I was doing that because I just didn't know. And I'm kind of... And I'm saying to the kids, yeah, it's partly your fault because you never told them. Mm. Like you're telling me stuff they don't know. Like,
because
why
teenagers communicate
them
so well with their parents at the best of times.
All the time. Do you know what I mean? And for me, it's so important for my job that I get a relationship with that teenager.
Yeah, 100%.
I actually talk, I love teenagers. I think they're great. They're challenging, but I think they're great. I like talking to them, and I think they've just got such great ideas and that. So they'll tell me stuff. And because I ask very specific questions, and they can see where I'm going, and they can see that I'm treating them as though they're adults.
Giving them agency.
Give them that I need to speak to them.
Yeah.
I need to ask them. I mean, it's all 8-year-olds. When I ask them about restless legs and they go, oh, yeah, I have that. And the parents are going, you never told us. And the kid's going, well, you never asked.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of conversation that I have with teenagers. And so parents are often trying to do what they think is right.
Yeah.
So you've got to give them that. But if the kid is not talking to them, if the kid says, I'm just not sleepy, and the parent's going, of course you have to be sleepy. You've done soccer, you've done this, you've done that, you've done that. Of course you have to be sleepy. If the parents dismiss that, the parents go, you have to be sleepy, and the kid's going, I'm just not. Okay, then you have a problem because the parents are asking the kids to do something they biologically cannot do. Just can't go to sleep. So then you have a disconnect there. So I think, but I do think there are also parents who are very permissive and kind of go, well, just go to sleep when you're tired, you know, and no, you can't do that. It is your job as a parent to kind of go, there's a discipline about sleep. There is a routine you have to have. You do need to set yourself up so that you can fall asleep. You can't just do it whenever. Right.
This is exactly the kind of conversation that I envision having. There's no silver bullet, unfortunately.
Mm-mm.
And surprise, surprise, as we all know from the different professions that we engage with children, having an honest conversation with them where they're not perceiving an agenda or judgment and just giving them the agency to start understanding their own minds is part of the journey towards being a functional adult, being a functional human being in society. Mm. And even with adults that we find have challenges emotionally and mentally, if you take them back to self-understanding and understanding their own minds, as you said, I'm an early bird, I'm up early, I'm the same as you. My wife is exactly the opposite. I'm up at 5. My best time of the day is a coffee with the sunrise coming up, a bit of mist on the ground.
I have never seen the sunrise.
The cat's around. And then I'll work like a demon until 10 o'clock. And then I do the faff around stuff. By 3 o'clock, I'm back at my desk and I've got a very functional, that second boost you're talking about allows me to go through to 8 o'clock. But you need to understand that about yourself. And if you're in a privileged position to be able to manage your work phases, but it makes you a more functional human being. You know, how many teenagers would be good coming home, sleep, going to bed at 7 o'clock after a light snack, waking up at 12, and then having a meal that's in the microwave and working for 4 hours and then going back to sleep again for 4 hours.
Mm.
They would probably be much more functional human beings than losing all of that. And there's some kids who go home and just say, so I crash for 2 hours when I get home and then I'm ready to go again.
Exactly.
But they've been given the agency to understand that about themselves and what it affects. And I think if there's anything for parents to take out of this for professionals is have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the right questions, and teenagers respond very well to honesty.
Mm-hmm.
They respond very well to somebody who genuinely has their best interests at heart. And I think that's what we need to encourage around sleep as well.
Mm-hmm.
Schools teach nutrition. We don't teach sleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Schools teach exercise. We don't teach sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's becoming more, we know we've taken on the technological burden of talking about that. We've taken on the burden of talking about sex ed because parents don't do that anymore, too embarrassed. We've taken on talking about good nutrition and we've taken on about good exercise. And now we need to start having the conversation about something that is a third of our day. And literally affects our entire lives.
Well, that is the point. The other two-thirds of your life depend entirely on what you do in that one-third.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's got to stop being like, my day is important and my sleep is just a waste of time.
Yes.
It's got to go, I have to get my sleep right because then my day is right.
Well, if you want to see a grumpy headmaster deprive me of my 9 o'clock sleep, and my wife also hates me because I'm one of those guys.
Is this why you're stopping now? Because you're like looking at the time.
Exactly.
I'm just firing up here. I'm just going. Okay, I can go for another 2
Jax,
hours.
And Jax is getting her routine going, and I'm going, good night, babe. Goomf. I'm asleep, and she's sitting there staring at me going, I hate you. I hate you. But this is what it's all about. And there's less about should and more about self-understanding. And when teenagers demonstrate that they're in control of their lives through an understanding of themselves, they get more leeway because the trust equity is there.
Mm-hmm.
If you trust your teenager and they're doing well and they understand where they are and they do come home and sleep for 3 hours at 7 o'clock and then wake up and have that late meal and then work and they're performing well as human beings, you're setting them up for success as well. I'm just using it as an example.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I see it all the time because I do have this conversation with the teenager and then I say to the parent, do you have anything to add?
Yes.
Okay, so you are not the important person here.
Yeah.
This is the important person.
But it's often a conversation we're all having.
Mm.
Because, you know, my first conversation with a teenager is, why are you sitting here? Why are you coming to Edgewink? because my mom says I have to. Okay, so your mom's not in the room. I've heard her story, but it's your journey.
Exactly.
So what's your experience? What do you need? What is?
And you know, I mean, and you probably also find, you go, this teenager looks at you and goes, oh, this is actually somebody who cares about me, not just what my mom, and accepts that I've grown out of that primary school phase where my mom did organize my stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm moving into this phase where I need to start organizing it now. And I need to take charge of it. And when I talk to the teenager about how we're going to fix it, I go, are you okay? Does this resonate with you? Like, do you understand this?
And they
go, absolutely understand. I give the program to the teenager. I give the script and the invoice to the mom. I give the program to the teenager. Go, here's what you need to do. Do you understand it?
Yeah. And it's also,
they can do it.
You know, with the level of anxiety that we're seeing in our society, you know, for me, I say to the kids, the cure to anxiety is control. And if you're feeling in control, you understand what monster's under the bed, and you are able to direct it. And a lot of the anxiety we're dealing with is, I'm out of control, and sleep falls into that. I'm out of control of my sleep. Whereas if you're giving me agency over my sleep again and understanding that the anxiety levels around that
low. Because sleep is just so natural and everybody can do it, and why can't I?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell went wrong? Like, there's a sense like when you lose control of sleep, you have lost control of a fundamental issue in your life that you feel that everyone else can control, right? And the really tricky thing about sleep is you can't control it at all. It's an incredibly passive activity. Like, you know, you can't control it. You have just got to you have to abandon yourself to the forces of sleep. Okay.
That's your tagline. There we go.
You do. You have to feel sleepy and then you just have to let go. And guess what you can't do if you're anxious?
Let go. Well, thank you very much for your time. And I'm hoping that we start making these kind of conversations commonplace amongst different things. And what I would suggest is, if there's anything that you guys would really like to talk about, and that as a community we are able to better support each other in the same place. Thanks, guys. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your time.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.